Welcome to 2500 Del Monte Street, the oral history of Tower Records. Today's guest, Wendy Powell. Welcome back to 2500 Del Monte Street. I'm your host, Bob Zimmerman. I'm excited to have Wendy Powell on the podcast today. Everybody loves Wendy Powell, but how many people know Wendy Powell? Today, you're going to get an opportunity to learn about Wendy's journey as a young, music-obsessed kid with a dream to work in Stockton, California. And then, an even bigger dream to work in New York City, only to end up in Long Island. But she eventually realizes the dream of working in New York City, ending up at the Tower Store at 4th and Broadway. Most people throughout MTS knew Wendy as Stan Gomen's assistant for 13 years. Wendy will discuss all of that and a whole lot of other interesting insights during her time with Tower Records. So sit back and enjoy our guest, Wendy Powell. Okay, at this time, please welcome to the podcast, Wendy Powell. Wendy, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here again.
So this is take two. We had some audio difficulties, so we're gonna give another go. Wendy's gracious enough to come back and talk to us about everything once again. But this is the first time everyone's going to be hearing it. But Wendy, I think I speak for all managers, regionals, and department heads when I say how nice it is to talk to you today without hearing you say, hold on a minute, Stan wants to speak to you. So for those who don't know, Wendy, she spent time in the stores, but she was best known. She worked in the retail operations department as assistant to the chief operating officer, Stan Gomen, who we had on the first two episodes of the podcast. And Wendy is probably the keeper of secrets. Today, you can tell us as much as you'd like or as little as you'd like, but we're looking forward to hearing your journey working at Tower.
Very excited to be here. I think this is a super important thing. I love that you're doing this. Very cool.
Excellent. Yeah,
it's awesome.
Go ahead.
You go.
So let's start at the beginning for you. While we're talking about Tower, I think it, at its heart, this podcast is really about music and movies and books and pop culture and what it means to a generation and how we used to buy it. Tell me about your earliest musical memories growing up with your family.
So my dad was a musician, so I have all music. Like growing up, it was just all musical memories. He played, I think when I was born, I was on tour with him and he was playing in like old garage bands, in bands called like Lavender Blues and the Shaggy Wags. And I think he was on Welk Records for a little bit too.
And this is where did you grow up? Where was he playing?
At that time, I think when he was on Welk Records, we were in Hollywood and I was maybe, I don't know, two or something, very young. But then we followed that around, we moved to Mississippi and Florida and all over the United States following whatever band he was currently in. So it was all music all the time, pretty much until I was in high school. We were moving around, so it was amazing. It was.
And your father played what instrument?
He started as a drummer, but then he picked up guitar, and then he passed away actually right before I started at Tower. And at that point, he was like singing the blues. He was like a one man band. He had the harmonica, the guitar, the bass pedals, drum machine, one man.
Right.
type of Bojangles thing going. Gotcha. So he did it all. He ran the casino gamut. We moved to Nashville and did the country. So it was the whole entire life was, you know, following my dad doing music. So it was pretty incredible.
So you grew up listening to your father playing and stuff. Do you remember things that, at that point, you know, music's, it's in the family, it's what's paying the bills, it's all that stuff. But at a certain point, you know, the music you listen to, the radio stations you listen to, the stuff you listen to with your friends becomes your identity. What were the records that you and your friends were listening to as you were 12, 13, 14, 15? What were some of your favorites?
I think because I grew up with so much music, the radio was just always on. So I was kind of like popular music was always something that I knew. All of my friends were kind of like, how do you know the words to every song? How do you, you know, because I was just, I was always listening to music. So it was a wide variety, but I'd say, you know, I like to dance. So dance music, like my first single was Donna Summer, Hot Stuff, that nice. I ever purchased myself. Yeah. Nice. And then I think the next was like the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack or the Grease sure. soundtrack or something like that. But it, I think I settled, you know, with kind of like the punk pop Ramones type style of music. And you know, a lot of the 80s music, Duran Duran and Blondie and right. Sex Pistols, all of that kind of
era. And then aside from like seeing your father play, do you remember like a first concert you went to?
Yeah, funny. Like you said, I went to a lot of concerts watching my dad, but the first ticket I ever bought was to Mountain Air, which is a thing up here in California in the mountains, the foothills in Northern California. And it was like Huey Lewis in the News, The Cars, Berlin, Rat, R.E.M.
and R.E.M. I know, anyway, that's just throwing in Rat in the middle of that seems they all kind of go together, but yeah.
Hysterical. But yeah, R.E.M., like it was really early, 1984, and Michael Stipe had a broken leg and just, you know, played an excellent show.
So it was probably like on their third album.
Was it 84? Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. It was a great concert, but very bizarre lineup.
Yeah. Yeah, that actually sounds yeah. cool though. That's I like really eclectic lineups like that. And so how did you first become aware of Tower Records?
I was living in Stockton, California, and it was kind of like after my dad died. And when we started talking about this podcast, I was kind of like, why did I go to Tower? I don't really know. Like, I wasn't someone that hung out there all the time. I was in music stores and stuff. But I think because my dad died, I, for some reason, like, I don't know, maybe it was in my, I don't know, subconscious, you know, I wanted to stay with something that had music. Cause I mean, I really tried hard to get a job at Tower. I just started going once, twice a week, asking, do you have any job openings? Do you have any job openings? Is there anything, you know, I can do? When are you hiring? Filled out an application, filled out another application. And so I think maybe it was connected somehow, you know, so some reason just to keep music in my life.
Yeah. So yeah. How did you ultimately end up getting the job? I mean, if you're in there bugging them all the time and they're not hiring you, how'd you eventually get in?
He asked me if I babysat too. So I was like, yes.
You're the hiring manager?
Jeff Goen. Yeah, okay. Jeff Goen and Gary, Jeff was like, well, do you also babysit? I was like, yes, I also babysit. And they're like, all right, come on, quit bugging us. You're hired.
Oh, nice. Okay. So you worked at Stockton for how long?
I worked at Stockton for, I think it was a little over a year, 86, 87. Yeah. And that's,
a clerk position. Did you do any other stuff or?
I had the new age section, which was a yawn. And sorry,
any a lot new of John age. Tesh.
Mannheim Steamroller was really, I had to keep stock on that at Christmas. That was a big deal. That was the biggest new age. But I had Blues too, which was pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
And I learned a lot about blues.
Excellent. And so you're working at Stockton, and at some point you decide to go east. What happened there?
I worked with two Tower Golden Children, Del Bassey and Sunita Bardwaj. And Sunita, my friend, saw a posting that they were hiring in New York City and was like, "You want to move to New York?" And I was like, "Okay, yeah, let's move to New York." And it was for the CarPlay store, which is in Long Island. And, you know, we knew Long Island. We did look at the map, and it was like, okay, there's New York and here's Long Island. They're right there, you know. Stockton is right next to Lodi. It's going to be right close, right? So we applied for the job. We met at the corporate office, which we'd never been to before, and met the manager, and he's like, "Yeah, it's going to be great. Come out. You can work." I was going to be the head of shipping and receiving, and she was going to be the cassette buyer, I believe. And they moved us out there. We landed on the plane at JFK Airport. We were so excited, you know, this new chapter in our life. She was 20. I think I just turned 21. And the manager picks us up, and we start driving away from the city, and we're like, "Hey, that's the city. Aren't we going to there? That's where we're going, right? The skyscrapers there. Let's go. Radio. We see all of New York City. It's amazing." And he's like, "Oh no, we're going to Long Island." And we're like, "Oh, okay." And then we keep driving and driving and driving. And all of a sudden we're like, "Oh, okay. We didn't know." I didn't realize at all that it was that far away from New York.
Yeah. It's a hike.
It's a hike. Yeah.
So how did that end up going?
It ended up being great. Carl Place was fairly, a new experience for us. We were, you know, a couple kids from California, which moving to Long Island, it was a new, like, frontier, kind of, like, not frontier, but it was just all new experiences. Everything was new. The store was huge compared to Stockton.
Sure.
It had a conveyor belt. Receiving was downstairs, which
DC,
was
Washington, D.C. was the same way.
Conveyor belt was so cool. Like, I remember being like, "Can we ride this? Can we go?" I didn't ever do that, really. But I thought that was really amazing. And we ordered so much more stock too. So that was like, for me, receiving, I had two people working in receiving with me, and we were just constantly ordering, pricing, stocking. Just it was much bigger deal than, you know, working at Stockton as the shipping. Leaving.
And when you were there, were you there as part of the grand opening or shortly after? Okay. So it was all right. So all the bells and whistles. Yeah,
exactly. So we stocked the whole store. So there were like giant trucks just bringing in merchandise, and we were really stocking that store, building racks and stuff like that. It was my first 18, you know,
gotcha
thing. Yeah. So it was incredible.
And so from there, so at anything exciting happen at Carl Place? Any, like for your grand opening, did you guys have any in-stores or anything? Anything?
I was trying to remember what our grand opening in-stores were, and I couldn't, but we did have Elvis Costello come in, and he would, you know, hang out. He would stay and hang out with the staff and, like, not run Reg, but he was like standing at the reg, like, he might want to run the reg. He might run the register.
Just hanging out on Long Island.
Yeah, exactly. And he would sing songs from the register and stuff like that, which was pretty cool. And then I think probably for me, being a Ramones fan, we had a Dee Dee King in store, which was Dee Dee Ramone. And I don't think I could really talk to him because it was Didi Ramone, and I was just amazed.
The question is, could he talk to you? He was going through a rough time during that.
Yes, he talked. He did. He had conversations. Yeah, that was a
weird record.
That was a weird record, right?
Yeah. So rapper. Cool. Yeah. So, how long did you stay at Carl Place?
We were there for a year.
Okay.
And then decided, well, the whole year we were asking, you know, we enjoyed working there. The staff was great. Like every tower store, they had some phenomenal buyers there. Like the Oldies buyer, Johnny O'Hanlon, he just knew everything Oldies. He was incredible. And there's those people in every single tower store, which is, you know, memorable. Yeah. But after about a year, we had begged Matthew Koenig, the regional manager, to be at the downtown store. We wanted to be in the Village. And that is what finally he was like, all right, I got this manager needs an assistant. Winnie, you're going to do that. Sunita, I need you to be in cassettes. Let's do it. So we moved out there. And I think Hetty helped instrument that process to help us move through that.
Right. And so you lived, how far did you live from the store in the Village?
In the Village, we ended up moving. Me and Sunita moved to probably, it was a Lower East Side. We lived across the street from McSorley's, which is like one of the oldest bars.
And yeah.
Yeah. And we were able to just to walk to work.
And it was just the two of you in the place?
Yeah, it was one of those railroad flats with the bathtub in the kitchen, you know, you had a little right. closet, the bathtub, and then you had at the end of the flat, it was like a toilet in a room. It was very new to us California girls, but it was an experience. There was a lot of, that was in the late 80s, so there was a lot of crack going on, and it was like the Village was happening, buzzing, but also there was a lot of, you know, a lot of drugs and stuff. So I remember stepping over people smoking crack as we were walking into our little apartment there, which was pretty different too. New experiences.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. So talk about the energy in that Village store. I mean, that was, for all intents and purposes, I mean, it was just a hub. It was, you know, where people met up and where people did things. What was the energy? And talk about it from the standpoint of being an employee in the store. How was that?
So when we were on Long Island, we were trying so hard because we'd been to the Lincoln Center store, which was an incredible store too. But just that vibe in the Village, it was constantly buzzing, constant energy, constant, you know, you kind of just, when you walked in the store, even as just like a, you know, not working there, just as someone there, you kind of immediately felt famous, you know, just like being in the store. It was just like a constant cool vibe. The artists there, and they had their own art loft, which is pretty
the store cool. artists.
The store artists, yeah.
Yeah.
They would create these, you know, the artwork for the album covers, all of the different artwork. They were allowed to just run wild, and they really did. And it was kind of like walking into a museum of rock and roll, you know, just amazing artwork jumping out at you, records everywhere, people just buzzing around. It was like in New York, people would be like, okay, you guys want to meet up? Yeah. Okay. See, meet up a tower. Everything was like, let's meet up a tower and we'll go from there. Let's meet up a tower and we'll go from there. Like I was talking to my husband who also worked there, and he was saying like the NYU was right there, and the frat houses, it was such a popular place that they would send their like pranks to tower down
right.
to the Village store, and it would be like, all of a sudden you'd look up on the mezzanine and somebody naked would be walking down the stairs because that was a frat prank for them to that they had to do because there were so many people always there. It would be like the biggest worst thing you could do as a frat prank, I guess.
How about So the other thing too is you're right around the corner from where the Village Voice is published. The Village Voice comes out, and you know every issue was like, you know, 20 pages of tower ads, you know, of what's going on and everything. What was it like in terms of you know, people shopping there? I think you mentioned to me that Spike Lee filmed part of Moment Better Blues in the jazz section, and for some reason I thought he filmed that at Lincoln Center, but it was 4th and Broadway.
Oh yeah, it was 4th and Broadway. He might have done some at Lincoln Center too, but the part that he did in the jazz room was at 4th and Broadway, and I remember it because we had to get Wesley Snipes' credit card to decline. It wasn't really his credit card, funny enough, but we had to have the credit card machine say decline, so we were running so many credits trying to get it to decline. So definitely it was on that floor, and it was filmed there. It was pretty incredible. All the people just jazz. Sorry about that. But yeah, it was amazing. And Spike Lee was there. He scouted the place. I think that he previously, he shopped there a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you guys were right down, I think it was on Lafayette Street, was Keith Haring's Pop Shop.
Yeah, he would also shop in the store. One time, somebody handed me a pin, and it was like one of the Keith Haring pins, and they were like, oh, that's Keith Haring, he wanted to give you that. And I was like, what? Really? But he had already like walked out of the store. So that kind of thing, they were just, I don't really know if it was Keith Haring who handed me that pin.
Right, right.
He was in the store often, so it could have been, but those kind of weird situations were always happening there, like nonstop excitement.
Yeah. And then any other, while you were there, your position was you were the assistant to the store manager?
Yeah, it was.
Who was the store manager? Was that Howard?
Yeah. Do you remember Howard?
Howard Suspettus. I never met him. Mm-hmm. His name's come up quite a few times with the people we've talked to.
Yeah. He was I was his assistant. So I kind of worked downstairs in the cassette department in the back with really close to like count out and receiving. So I had we had a big window that we could like see out onto the cassette floor. So there wasn't a lot of action. The rock floor and the mezzanine was where everything was happening. Like Def Jam and Island Records were close by too. They would come in and poach our employees. That happened a lot.
Hiring them away.
Yeah, that was never, you know, a happy event.
They frowned
upon that often.
Yeah. Yeah.
Same with record labels taking any of the record labels taking our staff.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That was a pretty common thing though. I read in one of the Nirvana biographies, they were flown down to California, and they were talking to an A&R guy, and they said, well, what's your previous experience? And he's like, I used to work at Tower Records. Like, that was literally, you know, they're like, oh, okay, that's how you become an A&R guy. So how about any in stores that you recall? Anything going on in the village that was?
There was like Susie and the Banshees. There was, I think there were so many, like you can... Green Day, but I wasn't there during that. There's so many. The ones that I remember, Susie, I remember John Waters, who was pretty amazing. There were some people that would just stay and sign every person's, you know, memorabilia. And John Waters was one of those people that just stayed for hours and hours until the line ended, which was...
That's amazing.
Yeah.
He's amazing.
Yeah, he really is. He's cool. Yeah. But working in that store, there was kind of like everyone who worked there, not everyone, but a lot of people who worked there were in bands too. We had like the Count Out Girls were the Cycle Sluts from Hell.
Really?
So, yeah.
Amazing. So that's how they got to know each other, was being in Count Out?
I don't know if they started the band in Count Out or if they were already in the band, but they were intimidating Count Out Girls, Cycles Us From Hell.
Right, right.
And then we also had like band Borscht, who works in cassettes, a band called The Thing, Jesse Upsbaum, he worked in cassettes, The Casualties, just all of these like Bridge and Tunnel kind of Lower East Side type bands that also were employees. So everywhere you, all the music you were hearing could be, you know, their local band, which they right. normally wouldn't get played on the mezzanine, but the mezzanine would play their music. So that was kind of exciting. You work at Tower, you get that little extra perk of, okay, well, you're in the village and now we're playing your band to the entire rock floor and mezzanine.
Right.
So there, it was constant local, I don't know. It was just kind of morale, yeah. awesome morale for that type of thing.
Cool. And then you were in the village for how long?
I was there for 2 years.
Okay. And what motivated you to moving back to California?
We got a call, a message on our answering machine. Stan, I guess, was looking for an assistant, and I don't know if he intently was looking for somebody who had been in the stores, had retail experience, but I think so. He had asked Teddy Kim to be his assistant, and she was like, I think I want to stay in New York. She never wants to leave New York. And so she recommended me. He called me and I was kind of interested and still living with Del and Sunita. And we talked about, you know, do we want to go back to California? And it was kind of like, okay, we can do this. And so I called Stan. He flew me out there, interviewed. I told him I was a package deal with Sunita. Uh-huh. And he ended up hiring me, and we moved out there. I had never really met him before.
Right.
I'd only like really heard, like, I met him once in Stockton. He came into the store there and kind of like yelled and at us and said, the back room needs to be cleaned up. This is the worst receiving department I've seen in my life. It's a mess. Clean it up, straighten it up. And then, you know, I was there for another year and a half and never saw him again and never saw him. I think he might've come out to Carl Place for the opening maybe, but hadn't seen him in years. And now I'm going to interview with him. So I was a little scared.
He's
a
legend. Sure. I mean, he can definitely be intimidating.
Yeah.
to be kind.
Yeah. Yeah. Hedy was very much like, don't be intimidated by him. It's just a person. I'm like, all right. Okay.
Yeah.
But I was still a little nervous, but ended up taking the job, moving back there. Ended up working for him for 13 years.
So tell us about all 13 years. No, I mean, so lay out for me, you know, in a nutshell. I know you can't talk about everything you did because I'm sure whatever came up is what you did. But, you know, the assistant to the chief operating officer at a time when the company was just, you know, opening stores, and then a lot of the stores that we had overseas were being run through Sacramento. Just a lot going on. I'm guessing no 2 days were the same. It never got boring.
It did not ever get boring. Every day was different. And like you said, it was a lot of getting people on the phone, making sure that when I was getting them on the phone, that they were like, okay, this is just a call. It's going to be okay. Making sure everything was all right. A lot of getting people on the phone. But Stan, one thing that he was really good at is he would allow us a lot of freedom to, if he had an idea, we'd be like, okay, hey, me and Sunita were kind of boots on the ground retail. So we had worked our way into, it was record division at that time, changed to retail operations. We're like, hey, maybe we should like track, can we create a system to track customer complaints? Because you can imagine there were a few.
Yeah. So you're saying at the time we had no real department tracking that or keeping any kind of records on that.
We had Teresa and Franny and Christine out of Russ's office. They would, you know, take the calls, send a gift card, say, you know, sorry or whatever. It usually wasn't sorry, but just basically like, okay, this is, we understand, we hear you. Here's a gift card. Thank you for shopping at Tower. But we wanted to, from coming from the stores, we were thinking that, you know, the stores are really, they were really competitive, especially the top 10 stores. Mm-hmm. So we thought, well, if we could say this store has 25 customer complaints in 1 month and this store only has 14, we could get them to compete a little bit. So we thought that if we started tracking it, it would work. And it kind of did a little bit. And also then the gift cards were coming from the store, not necessarily from the corporate. So it was more meaningful to the employee, to the right. customer or, you know, whatever happened. So that was one thing, you know, we thought about with Stan and he was like, yeah, okay, go ahead, try it. Don't mess it up. You know, there was always that, like, don't mess it up. And it was like, oh, okay, we better get this right.
Right, right.
That was interesting. And so we took a lot of customer complaints for a while. That was a big part. But then, like you said, every day was something different. I also talked to the record companies. They would want, you know, this amount of Madonna purchased and what would the deal be, you know, and Stan was always working those returns and all the different deal processes that we had to make sure that we weren't eating 300,000 Madonna's, you know, CDs or something that they didn't sell.
Right.
So there was a lot of that. And then getting that information out to the stores.
Right.
So that was this big buy.
And that's probably, I'm guessing that's about the time that someone like George Scarlett came on board to lighten the load on that and be able to explain that to the stores. George Scarlett was part of record division and he would write memos sometimes weekly, sometimes once a month, sometimes several times. But, you know, the stores always look forward because he basically tried to teach store managers and store personnel how the music business worked and how Tower worked and why. On those rare occasions where we would buy something corporately, at least, you know, in the early years, not the last couple of years when we were forced to, and the benefits to it. So, that's probably what was going on there.
Yeah. His memos were famous.
There were people who literally just had a binder that said Scarlett memos.
Yeah. And he was an incredible writer. He should have been a writer.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So at this time, in whatever we want to call it, record division, retail operations, it's Stan and you, and then Bob Delanoy was in there.
Bob was in there.
And who was his assistant?
Julie Morris for a while.
Okay.
And then I think Julie Morris, and I don't remember who came after her, honestly. And Karen Simmons. And Karen Simmons would take the sales. So people would call her every morning and she would key in their sales from each store. That's just pretty incredible. If you think the whole corporate office ran operations for the entire stores, all of the stores.
Yeah.
Even though the stores were very autonomous, we still, you know, your communications came from the communications division. Your, you know, everything came from a department within 2500 Del Monte. And Karen ran the singles as well. And I remember one day she comes running out of the little back office in our area and said, "I just got off the phone with Dolly Parton." And we were like,
"Oh, wow." What?
She's like, she was so nice. She just wanted to see how our sales were doing.
Wow. Yeah. So going back to working for Stan, I don't have to tell you, he was an intimidating figure. When I became a manager, I was told very early on that if he shoots you shit, if you shoot it right back in a gracious way, you were going to be fine with him. He knew that you could take it and you could get right back. But I literally watched grown men you know, 10 years older than me, Shake, when he came to town. My very first manager meeting, it was called by our regional. There's seven store managers, some who had traveled 3 hours to get to the meeting. An hour into the meeting, there's a phone call. Stan's coming to town tomorrow. The meeting was called off and they were told, go back to your stores and make sure they're perfect. So that's
check your understock. Make sure there's understock.
Yeah. So talk to me. So again, we joked about it at the top of the hour about, you know, you having to make the phone calls, you know, for him and stuff. But talk to me just about working for Stan and what it was like. I don't imagine it was like that every day, or you wouldn't have worked for him as long. But just talk to me about being in the eye of the hurricane and how you worked with Stan and just how things worked for you.
I think with Stan, he having so much experience and, you know, having tried so many things and had huge successes and fails too, he just really understood retail. And so that was intimidating if you were in the stores. In the office, I think Stan, I definitely have tough skin because of Stan. But learning from him with all of that experience really was huge in, you know, being a part of it and seeing it. But yeah, definitely tough skin. But like you said, if you fought back a little nicely, and he recognized that you bled Tower. I think as soon as Stan understood that, yeah, you bleed Tower Records like I bleed Tower Records, then it worked. He liked you. Then he liked you.
Yeah.
And he still might yell at you. And he definitely had those, you know, we had those moments. But he knew he was incredibly loyal, super loyal once he understood you bled Tower. Right. And that kind of for the record industry people too, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
If you loved Tower, then it worked out for you.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he definitely was like that. And he was 100%, 100,000% loyal to Russ. He like marched Russ. So I think that also intimidating because Russ was, you know, the kind puppet master and Stan was the bad cop, but it worked. It definitely worked. It got people to, like you said, leave the meeting and go get their store right.
Yeah. Which, you know, their store should have been right. But anyway.
And it probably was.
Yeah, probably. It was just that extra layer.
You'd find the needle in the haystack. Like, yes, hey.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You went through a lot working with Stan over the years. Probably one of the toughest days had to be the day that Stan was let go, towards the end, really, the beginning of the end at the very least.
The beginning of the end.
Yeah, talk to me about what you remember from that time and then just leading up to that day and just how everything went down.
Kind of going a little bit for that day, because that day was the end, was when they started bringing in these like consultants, and before they brought in new.
And these were consultants from the banks that now own the bonds and all that. Yeah.
I think we started with a consultant that Stan actually brought in. His name was Bob Lorber. I don't know if you remember that guy, but he was a consultant, and that's when we started doing a lot of strategic analysis. And I did a lot of minute taking back then, where we were doing action plans and, you know, just trying to bring in all the division heads and where can we make things right? Where can we, you know, that was kind of like the beginning where we were like trying to fix the ship, I guess. And then they started bringing in the bondholder manager people type people. Right. And that's when you started seeing a little bit of the fractures in the main office department heads, where some people were, you know, willing to work with these new people, and some people did not, well, I wouldn't say they weren't willing to work with them, but they went in to work with them knowing that the things that they were offering, because they didn't have any retail, any record industry or video or book or magazine or, you know, any of that experience, knowing that, yeah, we've tried that and that's not going to work, that type of thing. But they still had to follow these type of people around. And I think that that's the first, when that first started, we had to let Bob Dylan go. And that was really, that was like our big brother leaving. And that was really rough for Stan because they were tight, very
yeah.
close.
Yeah.
But then Stan, that day, and none of us had any knowledge whatsoever that they were going to let him go. And he, you know, it was just kind of like, they told us, and then in true Tower form, they were like, okay, you can take the day off. We'll see you tomorrow. And the whole girl, you know, me, Sunita, the girls in the office and the whole entire our little division there were just like destroyed, like just crying, destroyed. My husband says that there's only two times I ever walked in the house crying. One was when my band broke up, and the other one was the day Stan Gilmon got laid off.
Yeah.
And it was just, it was awful. And we were like, okay, we're going to quit. We're rallying. We're going to go to, we're out of here. And Stan was like, no, hold on. Just stay there. You know, we're going to turn it around. It's going to turn around. So he was very hopeful, you know.
Yeah.
Still, even the, you know, even then.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he told me that he was told flat out not to return to the office to even, you know, get his stuff or to be able to say goodbye or anything. And I know that was extremely difficult on him.
Yeah, I packed up his office, like everything in his office. And in true Tower fashion, I packed up even the old ketchup. Like I packed everything.
Right, right.
Like, anything that is in this office is Stan Gilmon's, and it's going to.
Yeah.
He was like, thanks a lot for all this. I didn't need all this, Wendy.
Right, right. Yeah.
Got it all.
And then for a short time, I think you as Kevin Cassidy took that position, you worked for Kevin for a little bit.
I did. Yeah. I think it might have been for close to a year.
Yeah.
And that's kind of Betsy left and Alan, there was one person who tried to turn the ship around, and then somebody else came in and tried to turn the ship around. And yeah, then I left Tower.
Yeah.
While there was still hope. I mean, when I was leaving Tower, I felt very, had that racking guilt, like, can I be helping it in any way? Is there something that I could be doing?
Yeah. Well, so let's kind of end on a little bit of happier notes.
Okay.
When you were in record division, there's clearly events that you got to take part in that you might want to share. What were some of the cool things that you got to do in terms of industry events or store openings or concerts that you got to attend?
I was really fortunate to get to attend some of these things. The store grand opening parties we got to do, and Carol from advertising, who would be hilarious on
Carol
your
podcast. Yeah.
Yes, she would be. She's fantastic and very funny. She would bring me and Sunita on these road shows to help open these stores and, you know, arrange the caterers and make sure people weren't getting into the stores. And so for Tower Lincoln Center, Elton John got to cut the ribbon, and I'll let Carol tell that story because she has really fabulous story about that. But me and Sunita and Carol got to attend this private event that he did for about in a hotel banquet room for about 100 people. And it was him and the piano. And it was like, I cried the entire time. It was just him and the greatest hits. And it was like once in a lifetime experience. You can never
Yeah, that's amazing.
It was amazing. And then another time, here's a little bit of a funny story. We opened the Denver store and Neil Diamond opened that store. So that was pretty huge. And there was tons of fans outside and stuff. But during his sound check, we were not allowed to look at him. So when someone tells you you're not allowed to do something, what do you stare? Oh my gosh. We were like looking for any shiny record, you know, that we could like reflect. But during soundcheck, we had to avert our eyes. That was like part of what his management said. So it was, I don't know, maybe he's shy. Who knows? But it was definitely very difficult to be like setting up the store and Neil Diamond's there doing a little sound check, and you're like, okay, I definitely am not looking at you as I'm looking at you.
Yeah, everyone's got sunglasses on.
Exactly.
Oh man.
Glassing. But then, you know, other events I think we might have touched on the record store opening stuff and the record parties that you basically fed yourself on because you made $8 an hour working in Manhattan, or, you know, $3.35 working in Stockton, whatever. So I got to eat sushi with the sugar cubes,
which is amazing.
Amazing.
I like Bjork, but sugar cubes even better.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That was the best of the Bjork days, I think. I was pretty amazing. And then we got to attend this like Arista 15 year anniversary that was an eating experience too. Record companies really spent a lot of money on food. But
that,
it was like,
was that, where was that?
That was at Radio City. It had like, it was.
So that's like Clive Davis's personal party, basically. So
it was. Yeah. And Whitney Houston was there. I got to meet Patti Smith and the after party.
Amazing.
And the after party at Tavern on the Green, which was like the first time I ever been there. It's like, oh, thank you. This is really nice food.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
It was fabulous. And we got to meet, yeah, like Whitney Houston, Lou Reed, Kenny G, yay.
Dionne Warwick. I didn't say anything.
Dionne Warwick. Yeah, Dionne Warwick. Uh-huh. She winked at us. It was just very amazing event. It was one of those things, once in a lifetime experiences.
Yeah, and then, one of those pinch me moments.
Yeah. And another one, I'll give you one more. Tower Mexico City, we did the opening party there as well. And Michael Jackson would not come into the store, but he pulled up out front.
Wait, was he scheduled to be at the store?
No, he wasn't. Happened to be in Mexico City at the time.
Okay.
And so he like pulled out front of the store, parked a limo, and just put the glove out the window.
And you're sure it was Michael?
Oh yeah, it was, because the management, the record label told us, you know, he's going to do this and stuff. And Russ might have walked down and had a conversation with him, but all we saw was the glove, and
it
was incredible.
That's wild. So
yeah,
that's great. Those are some pretty amazing things. How about one of my favorite things? I know. Well, I think everybody loved the Tower Annual Conference, TAC. It was that once a year time when I remember the first time I went, I didn't know anybody except Tim Devin. And all I saw was grown men backslapping one another and you know, laughing and leaving to go to the bathroom and coming back even happier. And yeah. just lots going on. But as each year went on, it was about, you know, learning about the company and seeing the bands that the record labels were promoting, but it was more about widening your circle of friends and coworkers. But talk to me about some of your memories from the Tower Conference.
I think those conferences were super key to the morale of the management, and it really allowed people to do their like, oh, that happened in your store too? Because every store was so autonomous, but every store had its own, like I think of it as its own, you know, Empire Records movie, but Tower Records movie, you know, every sure. store had its own movie. And I think just getting all of those managers together to talk about the things and share it was huge.
You didn't feel like you were on an island. You're like, oh, you deal with that too.
Yeah.
That was exactly. That was a big thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, some of the things that I remember so much about, like how amazing the dinners were, right? They were just like ice sculptures, and the record companies, again, like to spend money on food.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we also did like, remember the Tower fashion, you know, I remember I did a fashion show at the convention. I got Stan and Russ on stage doing a little dance with Tower clothing on. Yeah. That was interesting and fun. And then me and Carol Mott did Wig TV, where we would put on wigs and do little roaming reporters and ask people who they slept with and all that fun stuff.
Yeah. Was anybody honest about in their answers?
I think that sometimes they were standing next to the person that they might have slept there you go. With. Yeah. And so then it was like some crazy eyes.
I do remember Wig TV. Absolutely. Well, excellent. And then we just have a couple more minutes here. Take a second to talk to us about, you know, the interactions you had with Russ. You were as close to Russ proximity, and then probably just having worked there so long, just being close to him in terms of the job that you did. You saw him as much as anybody else. Talk to me about what he meant to you, what you think he meant to the company. Just any thoughts you had on Russ and what it was he provided us.
I think you could talk about Russ forever. You know, he was like that kind of that human that is like so kind and so interesting. And so he was kind of like one of those people that is a story collector. He would like really listen to people. So he would call you into his office and what are you listening to? He just wanted to know what's going on in your life. What's fun? What's happening now? Just constant story keeper. And I think that was very magic about him. And he made everyone who talked to him feel important, you know, like being, they were heard. And
he was fully present for any conversation. Really. Yeah.
Yeah. Even if it was ridiculous, you know, I'd be like, no, that's not ska music. And he'd be like, okay, well then show me what it, you know, even if it was a ridiculous conversation, he was just very fully, like you said, fully present. Amazing. He was the kind of person, like I invited him. I had a little tiny apartment, and at Thanksgiving, anybody from Tower who was like from out of town and worked in Sacramento, or, you know, their family, they weren't going home for a family, I would have them over for Thanksgiving. Stephanie Gendrew, you might know her.
Oh yeah.
So one year I made a turkey and I was like, Russ, you know, I'm having some Tower people over. If you want to come over to my little apartment. And I showed up, and sadly my turkey caught on fire and we all had to like kind of crawl out of the apartment because it was filled with smoke. But Stan and Russ were, you know, they showed up at that. And Russ was at my wedding. He knew my kids.
Yeah.
And then Patty, you know, were amazing. Incredible together.
Yeah.
And I'm blessed that I knew him, that I got to spend as much time with him that I could cry.
I know. He was one in a million. Absolutely.
He really was.
Wendy, it only took a couple times to get this right. I want to thank you for taking the time and sharing your story and reminiscing with us about a pretty magical time. You know, it's funny we've all kind of moved on, but we really haven't. And so to be able to spend this time and talk about a really important time in our lives is really quite magical. And I appreciate you being a part of this.
I appreciate you doing it. I agree. It is super fun. It was amazing. And you're doing an incredible job at steering the conversation. I appreciate that. Having never podcasted before.
Well, I'm starting to, so it's fun, but thank you again. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
I want to thank Wendy Powell for taking the time to talk with us. So we spoke for close to an hour, and I can't believe we never discussed the Groovy Ghoulies, Wendy's punk band that she was the drummer in. One interesting fact, the Groovy Ghoulies opened for the Cramps at the Warfield on Halloween night in 1996. Now that would have been a cool show to see. Again, thank you to Wendy Powell. 2500 Del Monte Street, the oral history of Tower Records, is a production of Busy Buzzy Media. A very special thank you to Mike Slowmo Brenner for providing our theme music and all original music for our podcast. Mike Brenner has a Patreon page you can join for $5 a month. Go to www.patreon.com/Mike Slowmo Brenner. Please subscribe to and review our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. More importantly, please tell a friend or two about us. Check out our Instagram and Facebook pages at Tower Records Podcast. And don't forget, we have a related Facebook page, Induct Tower Records Russ Solomon into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Join us there in an effort to get Russ Solomon, founder of Tower Records, in the Rock Hall. I'm Bob Zimmerman. Thanks for joining us.